What Does Not Change? The eighth talk in a series titled Biblical Christianity 101 was presented by Nancy Scott on November 14, 2000, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
Tonight's topic is titled, What Doesn't Change? And as I explained last time, I've taken the liberty of revising both weeks' titles, topics, a little bit, because I really had a hard time coming up with a way to talk about, in one week, what changes and what doesn't change. And so instead, I decided to talk about what changes and what doesn't, on the one hand, about our moral nature and ability, and that's what last week we spent looking at, and this week, what we'll look at changes and what doesn't about the quality of our lives, about the way life is for us, if you will. Okay. So last time we talked about how our core sinfulness doesn't really improve, but rather our faith does, and our perspective undergoes a radical change that has implications in our choices and our desires. And over the course of our lives, our longings change in light of our failures and our understanding of it. But we don't really cease failing, morally speaking. So that change in perspective we saw huge, and especially in light of our innate rebellion against God, which leaves us not seeing clearly, which how I'm understanding that when I say we don't see clearly is we don't see from God's perspective. We don't see things as God sees them, which is ultimately more real and more true. So our rebellion leaves us not seeing things clearly or seeking God on our own. So we describe this vision of life develops over time, the implications about how our lives and choices are changed in light of that perspective change, producing a struggle with the sin inside of us for maybe the rest of our lives, the rest of our lives. I would like to clarify one thing. I was describing how we develop a longing for goodness that deepens over time in the wake of our broken choices. This longing for goodness, I think, goes beyond our desire to escape painful consequences of our failures. And I just want to make that little bit of a distinction because I think that that's a subtle difference, but it can be a profound difference. In fact, it can be the difference between faith and not faith. And I think tonight's topic will help us maybe understand that a little bit more, or see how our faith gets purified over the course of our lives through trials and difficulty. Okay. Does that make sense? We begin to long more for pure goodness rather than just not liking what happens when we fail because it's uncomfortable and it's not socially acceptable and we have painful consequences in our lives. That's part of it, but this real commitment and longing for what's good and right grows inside of us over the course of our lives. Okay. So this week we'll look at what changes and what doesn't about, the quality of lives here and now. When we think of death, we tend to think of the end of life as a biological process, like when a heart stops. But from the Bible's point of view, death is not just a biological process, but is a subjective experience as well. We see it in all around us. Death is this principle of moral entropy, if you will. A long time ago, many years ago, Jack wrote an article called Life and Death in the Gospel, and he fills this out a little bit more than I will tonight, but if that is interesting to you, I refer you to a long ago News and Views article with that title. What I'm talking about with death is the way things disappoint us in this life, the way things break down, the way things don't come to the fruition that we anticipate that they might, or that we have hopes for things to happen a certain way, and they tend to not happen that way. We enter life as optimistic, going to change the world kind of youths, and by the time we hit 40 or 50, we slow down and wonder why it didn't quite go the way we thought it would. And that seems to be a really universal experience. Most people, if you talk to them over 50, while they might be very pleased with a lot of things about how their life has gone, it never quite measured up to the dream. And that's what I would call futility, death. It's all around us. We see it in divorce, alienation, war, murder, strife, hatred, hostility, all these things. Life, on the other hand, is the converse of that. Life is the absence of death in that sense. Life is what we are ultimately created for. The reason we come out going for it is because we're made that way. And the reason we get disappointed is that this world, the brokenness and fallenness of this world, is our trap. We can't quite get out from under that. So the eternal life that the Bible points us toward is the opposite of this kind of death that I'm talking about. So eternal life is not just being in existence for eternity, but it's a qualitatively different experience of life than any we will ever have this side of the kingdom. So life that is promised in the kingdom of God is the flourishing of our humanness. It's what we were created for. Because we were created for it, we long for more than this life seems to offer. It's the fulfillment of our creaturehood that we're waiting for. So, what changes and what doesn't? The futility of death around us does not change when we come to faith. Just like the death, the evil nature inside of us doesn't change in this life, neither does the creation that we live in change, or the qualitative experience of our life doesn't get automatically better. Now, granted, with a perspective change that understands purpose and understands a bigger picture, there's a lot going for that, and there's a lot of hope that we live with here, and there's a lot of promise there. But what I want to talk about tonight is having a good perspective, an accurate perspective on what's in this life, so that when life hands us difficulties, we don't have to be as surprised by them. They might be just as painful. I think understanding the role of suffering doesn't necessarily make suffering less painful, but it does make it more understandable, and that's a good thing. So, I want to read a story. I told stories last week. I'll tell one or two, but the one I'm going to read. This is about Doug. Doug became a Christian his second year in college. The next year, he transferred to a Christian college and in time met and married the woman of his dreams. Life marched on. They had three lovely children. Years later, however, instead of having reached the pinnacle he had expected in his Christian life, Doug found himself questioning why life hadn't gone the way he thought it would. On the surface, everything looked fine. He had a good job. His family was devoted to God. They were very involved in their local church, and they lived in a nice house in a nice neighborhood. But on the inside, he felt disillusioned and dissatisfied, unable to find himself in love with his wife of 15 years, and so depressed he was unable to carry on in even the most mundane of circumstances. He had tried praying, but nothing changed. He began to wonder if this God who he had been following all these years really cared about what he was going through, and if so, why he wasn't listening. What did Doug think life should look like? When asked, he said that when he became a Christian, he expected that his faith would allow him to rise above his circumstances. This meant that he would be able to glide through the worst times with a sense of joy and peace overcoming any troubles. Was that he didn't have troubles but he expected us to join peace to overcome them. This abundant life was his for the taking. It was what God desired for him, and God had made promises to this effect. This spiritual victory in Doug's mind included things like emotional peace and satisfaction in his deepest relationships, relational harmony in his family. He now felt strangely disappointed because these things weren't actually true in his life. For years, he questioned quietly what he might be doing wrong, but now he found himself wondering if God's promises were even real, or if he had bought into something that he was too naive to see through at the time. The big questions were on the table, questions he had avoided in the name of faith, because when he was honest deep within himself, he wasn't sure whether he would come out on the other side believing anything he had believed for the past 15 years. Doug's picture of Christianity was that it promised for him to rise above his circumstances. In the beginning, he pictured a life of faith as a life of blissful peace and serenity, with little relational conflict and much joy. Life didn't quite turn out this way. After 15 years, it was time to decide what he really wanted from God. Okay. I think that Doug's experience is similar to many of our experiences. The circumstances might be different. But there comes a time in most believers' lives where it doesn't quite go like we thought it would, and we have to decide what we believe to begin with and what might actually be true, and where we go from there. Do we go forward in the faith, or do we leave it on some level? So, what doesn't change? The quality of our life doesn't necessarily change. Doug found that he didn't have the serenity that he thought might be automatic now that he was a Christian. We live in a culture today that says the gospel promises many things. Preachers offer freedom from addictions, financial success, emotional healing, abundant life. And so we ask, are these promises consistent with the Bible's picture of the gospel? And are these promises consistent with what we experience about life here and now? Jesus said, "These things I have spoken to you, that in me you may have peace. In the world you have trouble, but take courage, I have overcome the world." It's really important to understand both what he meant by that and what he didn't mean. One thing that is clear was that he understood that life here was going to have trouble in it. As I mentioned briefly last week, in order to interpret passages correctly, we have to look at the context, and we have to look at more than just the few verses around it, but the context of the whole book and the context of the history and the author and the audience and what they were believing and how they would have heard what was said. So we have to understand the author's context separate from ours. Okay, so we've stressed that in the last few weeks. And the important question that comes up from this is, what did the audience expect and understand about life, and how would they have understood these words? Okay. Think about our own cultural context for a minute. We are bombarded with these messages. If we only drive the right car, drink the right beer, all of our problems will be solved. We take drugs for whatever ails us. There's no need to feel pain. Relief is readily available. We have machines to do most of the work of life for us. And why would anyone feel pain when you don't have to? Doesn't make any sense. We have all kinds of ways to address the pain in our lives. So this is the cultural context I'm talking about broadly. I think as Christians, we're so saturated with that message has gotten imported into our Christianity, especially in the last, say, 50 years. There have probably been many other times in history when various messages have been imported from the culture into Christianity. But I think even in the last 50 years, if you think about, the cultural context of even my parents' generation, they had the Depression, they had World War II, life was harder, especially than it's been in the last, 8 or 10 years of vast economic prosperity here for most people. As a result, we live in a contemporary Christian culture that understands the gospel to be promising some kind of rising above of our circumstances and some kind of relief from struggle as what the gospel is promising. Another factor that goes into the misunderstanding, I think, is just our innate rebellion. We don't want to feel pain because, there's a natural sense that pain is a signal to us to protect us from things that are harmful to us. But as we anesthetize our sense of being able to know what pain is and what it's telling us, we lose our ability to navigate. We lose our ability to know what's harmful and what's helpful and how to relate to one another and ourselves in ways that are kind, even. So we certainly don't want to hurt, and that's understandable. But refusing to hurt is part of our rebellion. We don't value what God values. We don't see things like he sees them, and we certainly don't want to hurt. So we've gone so far as to create theologies that tell us it could never be God's will that we would suffer. If we suffer, then we believe we've stepped out of God's plan somehow, or we haven't understood how to get God's power to flow into our lives. We've decided that his will for us is victory and comfort, and we seek safety and security. So it's this rebellion as humans which has produced these theologies in which we no longer expect to suffer. So, that's our context. What about the context for the biblical authors? What did they expect and get from this life before and after they came to faith? The Jewish perspective context was a history of political oppression and hardship when Jesus entered the scene. They didn't live in the world of modern conveniences and medicine that we do. And they were confronted by the reality of life's uncertainty, I think, in a much clearer way than we are. Even death is very privatized in our culture. When people die, they die in a hospital behind closed doors. Not that long ago, when people died, they were laid out on the dining room table and dressed, and the family sat with them. It's a really different experience of even understanding physical death as a very real part of this life. Some of that's changing now, but there's still, by and large, people die alone and with strangers, the statistics say. So, the biblical audience was much more aware of life's uncertainty up front. They didn't have the same expectations that we do for healing and renewal in this life. Okay, so I want to look at the book of 1 Peter a little bit to try to uncover Peter's expectations and assumptions by looking at the advice he gave to the believers that he wrote to. So does that make sense? I'm going to try to understand what he was assuming about life and the quality of life by hearing what kind of advice he gave to people who were struggling. The people he was writing to were struggling, were suffering persecution in a big way. They were being persecuted for their beliefs. And he wrote to them in that context. Okay, I'm actually going to do a bad thing and kind of swashbuckle through this passage and just kind of read a few passages and make some observations about them and see what we can pick up from them. Okay, chapter 1, verse 6 and 7 says, "In this you greatly rejoice, even though now for a little while, if necessary, you have been distressed by various trials, that the proof of your faith, being more precious than gold, which is perishable, even though tested by fire, may be found to result in praise and glory and honor at the revelation of Jesus Christ." So, what's he telling them? He's, in a way, pointing them beyond their current struggles to a much further away outcome. He's saying, there's this promise out there of the kingdom This is now. And if you're distressed by trials, there's this proving of your faith that happens in that context that is actually much more valuable than being comfortable, kind of what he's saying, what he's getting at. Again, in chapter 2, verses 21 and 23, for you have been called for this purpose, since Christ also suffered for you, leaving you an example to follow in his steps, who committed no sin, nor was any deceit found in his mouth, and while being reviled, he did not revile in return. While suffering, he uttered no threats, but kept entrusting himself to him who judges righteously. So another thing he does is he points them to the example of Jesus' suffering, who went before them and was certainly suffering even more unjustly than they are suffering. They were suffering unjustly also, apparently. Okay. Chapter 4, verses 13 and 19. Beloved, do not be surprised at the fiery ordeal among you, which comes upon you for your testing, as though some strange thing were happening to you. But to the degree that you share the sufferings of Christ, keep on rejoicing, so that also at the revelation of his glory you may rejoice with exultation. Therefore, let those who suffer according to the will of God entrust their souls to a faithful Creator in doing what is right. So he encourages them with words about how what is happening to them is not unusual. And he exhorts them to hold on to their faith and not give up. And he goes on about the devil waiting to devour them, and he says that it's this kind of a test that tells whether the devil is able to devour them or not, whether they have faith. So then in 5:10, he says, after you've suffered for a little while, the God of all grace, who called you to his eternal glory in Christ, will himself perfect, confirm, strengthen, and establish you. And I think what he's talking about is bring you to mature faith, bring you to the outcome of faith, which is citizenship in this kingdom that we're talking about. So he reiterates that faith is ultimately the most important thing that they could possibly come out of this life with. And that the proof of this faith happens in the midst of these various trials that they're going through. Okay. So I want to notice also what he's not saying. It's hard to find anywhere in this book, if you read the whole book, where he says, pray more and you won't suffer. Or where he says, God doesn't intend you to suffer. Claim the victory that is yours through Christ. He doesn't say, identify the particular demon that you're dealing with and cast it out. He doesn't say a lot of those things that we hear a lot when troubles come. He doesn't even say, identify the sin in your life and repent of it, which is actually what Job's friends wanted Job to do, too. So that advice has been around a long time. So, has God promised victory over suffering and difficulty in this life? I don't think so. So, what evidence do we have that this part of our lives doesn't change? Well, we have Peter's worldview, for one. I think that we can kind of get where he was coming from about that. We also have other biblical authors' lives to look at. We can look at Jesus' life, Paul's life, David's life, Job's life, to see what actually happened before and after faith. Did their life circumstances improve? Did they become wealthy? Did they become free of struggle? Doesn't really look like that. And then there's this list of people in Hebrews chapter 11. I don't know if you've read that late, but I read it earlier today, and it's this famous passage, this hall of fame of faith. And as I was reading it, I was noticing all these different people's lives who the author identifies. And I want to read one short section of it because I just thought it was so profound. For one thing, all these different people, if you go back in the Old Testament and read about them, they all failed miserably at one time or another after they were believing and along the way. while they were following God. So there's something to that right there. So all these died in faith without receiving the promises, but having seen them and having welcomed them from a distance and having confessed that they were strangers and exiles on the earth. For those who say such things make it clear that they are seeking a country of their own. And indeed, if they had been thinking of that country from which they went out, they would have had the opportunity to return. But as it is, they desire a better country, that is, a heavenly one. Therefore, God is not ashamed to be called their God, for he has prepared a city for them. I think that it's really poignant that they died in faith without receiving the promises, and that that's the very thing that the author is pointing us to, is that he goes on to talk about what was happening when the people were dying, like when Jacob, when he was dying, blessed each of his sons. Joseph, when he was dying, made mention of the exodus of Israel. It's quite a passage. I won't take the time to read the whole thing, but I point you to it to take a look at that sometime. Okay. I think we have other evidence about what doesn't change about our lives, that the quality of our lives doesn't actually change. And that is from the context of our own lives and our own experiences. If we are painfully honest with one another, our lives don't become free of suffering once we come to faith. In some ways, the struggle intensifies because we not only struggle with the brokenness outside of us, but we struggle mightily with the brokenness inside of us. Okay. So, I'm going to tell a story now. I guess I'll just talk a little bit about, though, suffering, I think, does a couple of different things. One, it can clarify whether we have faith, and that's what the biblical authors are really referring to when the various authors talk about persevering. James talks about considering it joy when we encounter trials because the testing of our faith produces endurance, that kind of thing. So there's a testing of our faith that happens in the midst of suffering. But there's a lot of suffering that happens after our faith is tested. Excuse me. And after it is mature faith, there's still struggle. And I think the other thing that suffering does is it grows wisdom for us. It grows character qualities that are not ours until we go through these experiences. And these character qualities are things that we begin to value as we walk toward the kingdom, as we begin to have our perspective, as our perspective is changed drastically at first, it then continues to be changed over the course of our lives to value what God values. And apparently, God values faith and wisdom more than he values our comfort. And I think that's the perspective of the biblical authors. The story I want to tell is, I talked a little bit last time about my becoming a Christian again after many years as an atheist and kind of making this trek back to faith and being kind of tenuous about it. Within a few years' time, I was very involved in a Christian culture, even though the first few years I had really resisted getting involved in any kind of Christian culture because I'd had a bad experience with it before. And I'd been not exactly on their side for the last 10 years of my life and had not made a lot of friends in that kind of community. In fact, when I first started going back to a church, I thought, gosh, if they really knew, they would run me right out of here because I probably didn't vote the same way they did and probably didn't do the same things on the weekends that they did. So anyway, but within a few years, I got pretty involved with a particular church and I think I alluded to last time also about how I felt like, gosh, now that I understood what God had done for me, I wanted to serve him with everything I had. And I turned it into kind of running after him in a really big way, in a way that didn't really understand that it was still his job to get me there. Even though at this point it looked like, okay, he got me in, but now it's my job to really pursue him and find him and serve him. And that was a struggle for me. Well, part of what happened at that time was that I chose to go to the mission field. I worked as a fishery biologist, as an atheist, and when I became a Christian, I thought about ways I could use my professional life to serve God and came up with the idea of doing community development work overseas with a large mission group. So I applied, I got in, I went through some of their training, and I actually came to Oregon for a summer program. That's how I ended up in Oregon. I just came for the summer. Forgot to leave 11 years ago. But anyway, I came here for that summer, and the part of the experience that I wanted to share tonight has to do with this promise that I had in front of me of serving God and becoming a missionary. And there was a lot of mythology out there that I imagine still is there. But I was really convinced that I was leaving behind my home, my things, my family. I was bringing my dog with me, but that was about it. And pretty much everything that I still had fit in my car. And I did have some things in storage for future reference or whatever, but I left behind everything. And there was this kind of inherent promise with this missionary outlook that said, if you do that, then God rewards you. And God rewards you by kind of giving you that and more somehow, in some way. I didn't really ever think this through, what that would look like in regular everyday life. But I went running after thinking, I can leave everything behind and I won't need it. I won't miss it. I won't wish I had it because I'm doing this thing that is so good and so right. And there should be this quality of life God has promised to provide for me somehow in the midst of that. I didn't have any income. I had quit my job. I mean, I did the whole thing, you know. And I'm setting out with enough gas money basically to get to Oregon. And so fully expecting to live by faith and to trust that God was going to provide everything I needed once I got here. The first thing I was convinced of that he would provide was a place to live. Well, I got here and never found a place to live, interestingly, the whole summer. I lived in different homes for a couple weeks at a time, lived out of my car. Never the rent situation, now there's like a housing glut compared to 11 years ago. You couldn't find a place anywhere near here, especially if you had a dog. So God didn't exactly come through on this thing that I thought he was going to take care of for me. And it was okay. I had a roof over my head. It wasn't like, you know, I kept thinking, oh, you know, he's just providing the way I thought he would, that kind of thing. But he's providing, and that there's something true about that. I did end up house-sitting at a particular house for a few weeks at one spot, and it was in someone's home, and it was a nice home, and I enjoyed being there. I enjoyed being there because it felt a little bit like my own home, the one that I had left. And I really struggled with being there because it made me realize how much I missed my home and my things. And I was living apart from everything familiar to me, and I was on some kind of romantic quest that wasn't quite measuring up. And I was aware that I was really struggling with trusting God about it. And the thing I was struggling with was not so much I shouldn't miss these things or whatever. I mean, maybe that was part of it. But it was more, I really didn't think I would go without them. I really had this belief in place somehow that those things would be provided somehow. Does that make sense? And that all my needs would be met. Well, the final kind of straw happened when I was running out of money pretty fast and was believing that God was going to provide. And so much so that my gas tank was getting lower and lower, and I didn't really have money to put gas in the car. And I thought, you know, God has brought me here. He is going to provide. He's going to provide in time for me to not run out of gas. I ran out of gas over in West Eugene somewhere. It just sputtered and died. And now, How many people have run out of gas? I've run out of gas other times too. Running out of gas is really not that big of a deal. But it was a hugely significant event in the context in my life of what was going on. Because what it said to me was, God is abandoning me. And I had to completely rethink what I believed about God and what I thought he was promising me. And the whole thing, the comfort, the provision of relationships and stuff and home and money and the whole thing, I was going after to serve him, and he was not coming through. And so anyway, I tell that story because it was fairly simple things that ended up pushing into my face a real rethinking of what I was trusting God for and what I was believing about what my faith was going to bring me. And that was the first of a long process of coming to terms with what God wasn't promising for this life. And I had to come to understand that he had never promised to keep my gas tank filled. And he had never promised that I wouldn't miss my things if I left them behind. He had never promised that I would never go without financially, especially if I made a choice. I think that some of these promises can lead us to do fairly foolish things, actually, in the name of being faithful or something. I'm not saying that you never take risks. I think you do. And I have many times since then. And I guess what I'm trying to say is that there can be fairly mundane things that happen in our lives that really help clarify what we're believing. So the question that I ended up having to ask was, okay, I'm in this, I'm following God, what do I think I'm going to get out of this? That's really the question that came up to the foreground, was, am I going to get comfort? Am I going to get my needs met? Am I going to get my gas tank filled? Is that what the gospel is promising me? More than that, is that what I better get or I'm out of here? That's the big question. Because if I'm not getting that, and that's what I thought he was promising, see you later. I'm out of here. Because he didn't come through. So that became a test of my faith, and it was an opportunity to revisit what God was promising and understanding what I was willing to go without in order to persevere and trust him and keep following him, even if he wasn't going to give me those things after all. Does that make sense? Okay. So, how does a test purify our faith? So, first of all, when I talk about trials like this, what do I mean? Well, I mean any painful crisis that shows us whether we have faith or not. So, I want to revisit the story again and say that a year later, when I was still trusting God, even if I didn't understand anything about what that meant yet, I was still trusting God. And so what that experience showed me was that I have faith. Not that I hung on, but that he hung on to me. So I think that's an important distinction too. So any painful crisis that shows us our faith or lack of it, from any source in God's creation. So it can come from outside of us, from living in a broken, fallen world. It can come from inside of us as the result of foolish choices that crash down around us. It can come from any disappointment in what we thought we deserved to be given by God that he doesn't seem to be giving us. So these experiences are actually designed by God to purify and mature our faith. So here's the part that changes. I've been saying what doesn't change. Life continues to disappoint and be difficult. What does change is that we get to see the purpose and design of a God who is lovingly taking us through very difficult things in order to show us his perspective and to pry our fingers off of what we do and help us understand and know whether or not we value what he values, or whether we will come to value what he values. Does that make sense? If we hang in there and decide, I still want this thing, even if it doesn't look like I thought it was going to look, then God is giving us this great vehicle for showing us what we want. Okay. So he uses any number of circumstances and desires and events to bring these important questions to the forefront. And true faith will be deepened and strengthened and proven, which is why James can use words like consider it joy when you encounter various trials, knowing that the testing of your faith produces endurance. Again, Paul in Romans 5, tribulation brings about perseverance, and perseverance, proven character, and proven character, hope. And hope does not disappoint. Hope does not disappoint because it is God who is getting us there. Because God is the one giving us faith, it is his job to hold on to us. It's the function of a trial to show us that he is giving us faith. So from God's point of view, knowing that we have faith is more important than our comfort here and now. This is actually where assurance of salvation comes from, not from being able to put a date and time on when we made a decision, but when we see our faith come through life and death struggles along the way, then we can be assured that God is actually saving us and giving us faith. So, faith that is misplaced won't make it. If what I really wanted was some kind of provision or comfort that summer, that is what I really wanted, don't get me wrong. But that experience helped me to be able to clarify that I wanted that less than what God was promising in a really big way. So if our motivation for seeking God, our fundamental motivation, is to avoid pain and frustration of being human, rather than understand better and to trust God with it, then it's not going to work. We're not going to get through those times and keep believing. Okay. So how does it work? It raises life's most important questions. We're lulled into complacency by our comfort, and it forces us to address these questions. Who is God? What do I really believe about him? Can I trust him? What's the deal? Our faith is purified in this process, and faith is the most important thing we will ever come out of this life with, because it's on that basis that our salvation is promised, and it's good for us to know that we have faith. Okay, secondly, I talked about faith also produces character qualities, which, if we are God's, we want. In following the path into our suffering, rather than around it, we are given deep patience, courage, strength of character, calm acceptance, hope, and a willingness to take from God's hand whatever he chooses to give. These are not things that we have before we suffer, and they are things that are worth having. It's wisdom, and we don't have that until he gives it. And we don't value it until he changes our taste. So he's shaping us into people who share his character through this painful process. And it's the road to wisdom. So, the hope of the gospel is that we are now citizens of a different kingdom, and we are on our way there. Our hope is certain, and our suffering has a purpose and a design by a loving God whose priorities are not ours. He values faith over comfort, and a sign of maturing. I started thinking about, as I was preparing this talk, I thought about how this would have heard to me, how this would have sounded to me when I was 20, because a lot of you guys are in that age group. And I thought, ooh, I think I would have thought, no, not me. Or I would have thought, well, okay, whatever. And I think that that's okay, because some people, by the time they're 20, have really suffered, for one thing, and wouldn't react that way. I had suffered by the time I was 20, but I had not known I had suffered. I had done a lot of things to not know the pain that I had been in. And until those kinds of things start breaking down for us, we can convince ourselves that we haven't suffered. Some people haven't. I mean, had those things break down. Some people don't have them in place and know that they suffer. I guess what I'm saying is that there is a certain amount of wisdom that comes from having those coping mechanisms run their course and fail us that you might not know by the time you're 20. You might not know by the time you're 30, although I think there's a better chance of it. And I guess I just wanted to say that because I'm aware of my own lenses at that time in my life and the way that I wouldn't have really wanted to hear, because it's a very fun thing to hear, for one thing. And also, I don't think it's something that we need to go looking for or bringing on ourselves to say, well, okay, if this is the path to maturity, then how do I go out and get mature? Because it doesn't work like that. That's God's job too. And life brings us things to suffer with. We don't have to go looking for them. And kind of, I guess what I would say is, all in good time. I think that what you can come to them with is a perspective that understands what I'm talking about as the design for what difficulty does for us. Most of you have heard this story before, but I'll tell it real briefly. About 4 years ago, I taught a similar class on trials and suffering. And it was about a month and a half later that I got a call that my mother had had a major stroke and was probably not going to recover, but was probably also not going to die. And I remember that experience so well of having just taught this stuff and then thinking, here I am. This is it. You know, this is where the rubber meets the road. And what is this going to look like? And I had no idea what that was going to look like. And it was one of the hardest things I've ever gone through, was to watch my mother live for 2 more years without being able to say a word and without being able to make her wishes known and without being able to talk at all about what it felt like to be in a nursing home where people had to dress her and move her. And, I mean, I won't go into the details, but it wasn't pretty. She really couldn't move at all. She was pretty much paralyzed. She could move one side of her body, but she couldn't do it if she wanted to. She could do it automatically sometimes. So if you handed her a glass, she might take it and even drink it. But if you put it in front of her and said, take a drink, those pathways were broken, and she couldn't make her hand do that. So she was very disabled. So 2 years later, she died. And that's been about 2.5 years ago now. But I guess what I want to say about that is that I, going through that experience and looking back on it even now, I don't understand a lot of it. And there's a lot of questions that I have for God and for her when I see her again, about what that was like and what was up with that. But I know a really different level of understanding of trusting God on this side of that experience. And it's not something I can even articulate, but it's something I know. And I don't even know how that taught me that, or what exactly it is, or how to say what it is that I know differently. But it's different, and that's what taught it to me. And it was worth it. So, so he has promised to get us to the kingdom. He has not promised that it will be easy, but he has promised that it will be worth it. Romans 8, for I consider that the sufferings of this present time are not worthy to be compared with the glory that is to be revealed to us. So the biblical authors have in common that they are looking to the future, to the unseen, the invisible, to provide perspective on the struggles of life here. Meanwhile, here and now, it makes sense that we begin to lose our attachment to this world in favor of the one to come. And I think that's part of this process that we're into. This is not the world that will fulfill us. We go through this life making attachments to it and having them ripped out of our hands. That makes sense too, because we're being prepared to live somewhere else totally. So we are called to endure this race, to hang on all the way to the finish line, because the prize that awaits those who persevere will be worth the wait and the struggle. So it is our faith which is purified by this kind of suffering which will get us there. I just want to read in closing 2 Timothy 4, the last letter that Timothy wrote. He said, "I have fought the good fight, I have finished the course, I have kept the faith. In the future there is laid up for me the crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will award to me on that day, and not only to me, but also to all who have loved his appearing." So that's what we wait for. Okay. That's all. Questions? Comments?
What faith is?
I'll try. I think in very a very pared down view, I think that faith is a posture of the heart that begins to want what God wants. It's a combination of a heart that knows that what God wants is ultimately best, and that we aren't like that. So I think true saving faith has both of those components to it. One, we recognize that we don't look right from God's perspective. And we recognize that God's perspective is the right one. And we somehow trust that he will be merciful. So when I say a posture of the heart that wants what God wants, it encompasses that picture of recognizing our own weakness and failure to value what God values, and a desire to be that instead, and a trust that God is merciful to give us that.
Can you tie that in with your example of running out of gas? How does that
tie? Okay. Yeah. What running out of gas helped me see was that what I came into faith, not the kind I'm talking about, but when I came into the Christian culture and became a Christian, what I thought that meant was this thing. In essence, that I wouldn't run out of gas in that circumstance, because of the context, not just any time. I mean, you know, yeah, anybody can run out of gas, but you know what I mean by that, right? In that context, God would not fail me that way. And I saw that as him failing me. And I tell that story with humor because it's a humorous story, especially 11 years later. But at the time, it was a really big deal. I was hitchhiking on West 11th and thinking, where is God? He said this wouldn't happen to me. And that's really what I thought. And so what that showed me was, through a process, it wasn't instant, but it showed me that even if that isn't what God is promising, I think I still want what God is promising, even if I'm not quite sure what that is. If instead what he's promising me is to show me that I even don't want the right stuff, that I think running out of gas is what's important, he's showing me something about my faith. And because I'm still hanging in there later, wanting to figure that out and wanting to know what that means, he's showing me that I do have biblical saving faith, but it's not what I thought it was. Does that make sense? Does that help? Okay, thanks. That's a good question.
Are you equating suffering with temptation?
It can be. Not necessarily, but it certainly can be. Because I think that part of our suffering here does involve not getting things that we want. And that can be both good things that we want as well as bad things that we want. So if we want things that are not good, that are not good from God's perspective, he might frustrate that direction for us. And again, in that process, show us something about what we want and what's more important to us. I think we can also suffer with the deprivation of things that are good for us. Longings, a couple who desperately wants to have children and isn't able to conceive, things like that, that things that are good to want. So I don't know if that, does that address what you mean by temptation? Maybe you could give me an example. Right?
My example is just in James when it says trials, but my translation is temptation as opposed to trial being suffering.
Oh, okay.
So like when James says to count it as joy, he's saying the temptation, just even coming out on top when you're tempted.
Right, okay.
As opposed to like in Peter where he's actually referring to a physical persecution.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah, the people that James was writing to, they were struggling with real different things than the people that Peter was writing to. I don't know enough about the original languages to comment on that, but I assume, I would expect that that word is, that the temptation might be, in our jargon, might be equated to the temptation to give up trusting, to give up the faith, because we aren't getting what we want, or we aren't, or life isn't going the way we thought it ought to. Does that make sense?
Yeah, I was just, yeah, that's all I wanted to see. If just even being tempted is in a form, like, a, you know, it seems to me like there's a suffering like with Peter that is, he's referring to a real physical persecution because of the beliefs they held. It seems, you know,
right,
that's similar to Christ, which is a physical, an actual physical pain.
Mm-hmm.
And that there, but, you know, like in the reference that you gave of that first example, it seems like that's, there's more of a psychological suffering or there, you know, nobody's, you know, egging his house because he's a Christian or, you know,
right,
something like that.
Right.
It's just, didn't match up with a set of beliefs that maybe weren't right to begin with.
Right, right.
And
I think that that is more the context for James, because what the believers were getting that he was writing to was, it's been a long time since I've heard Ron teach on James. But it seems to me they were getting oppressed by people who were wealthier than they, and they were kind of measuring up and struggling with levels of living well and struggling with being poor, that kind of thing. And so it clarified their values too. He was saying a similar kind of thing, that if this is what they were trusting God for, to give them material wealth, then, and that didn't happen, then what is really behind your faith? Because if that's what it is, you probably don't really have faith. But if you want something different from that, then this suffering can prove that to you. Does that work?
Yeah, oh yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Definitely. Because it just seems to me there's a distinction between a result of beliefs that, like you, when you just said there aren't,
right,
isn't real faith or isn't,
right,
it's a misunderstood faith, and
right,
then you think that you're suffering, and you might even call it suffering, but it's, you know, it's, it's not even, it's just the result of improper belief or faith.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, although I think that that's a really normal experience as far as, you know, most of us come into faith not really getting what the deal is on some level. And those kinds of experiences help us know that, help us clarify that.
It's like you said, the perfecting of your feeling.
Yeah, right. I've known, you know, I know, even myself actually, probably heard the stories of people praying for parking spaces. I had a friend who, after she became a Christian, she just was so excited because she just got parking places. She would just pray for a parking place and God would give it to her. And she would have these great parking places. And I remember at the time thinking, no, that'll last for a little while. But her faith isn't really about parking places. And eventually, that's going to come clear. So, you guys, maybe some of you guys struggled with that tonight. Circling the block, praying for parking places. Well, there's a basketball game.
Apparently you went through, I wasn't here last week, but apparently you went through an extended period of time where you, I don't know how you described it, fell away or got way back in the faith.
Mm-hmm. I was an atheist. About as far away as you can get. I was an atheist for 10 years, so about as far away as you can get.
You were a Christian before and then you
yeah.
Do you personally see in your sojourn that God was also a part of that, or were you genuinely a Christian and then fell away and then came back?
It's a good question.
Because you were not, quote, being faithful. And my intent in asking that question isn't to put you on the spot. There's some people that I really care about in my life who have gone that same route.
Mm-hmm.
Their hearts are being tortured. Well, gee, does that mean I'm really a Christian because I struggled so much and sometimes I just really want to shut God? And sometimes
right.
I do.
You know, right, so. Right. I'll give two answers to that. One is, the main answer is, I don't think we know until the end, closer to the end of the story. And I think that if you had met me when I was 22... you wouldn't have been able to say, because this is what it looked like. I was an atheist. Now, from God's perspective and from the reality of what happened for me, I did hit a test of my faith in my college years that blew me out. I thought God was promising this thing. It didn't happen that way. And I said, this doesn't work. And if it's not what that is, then I don't want it. And that was my decision. And I walked away. And I stayed away for a long time. And God, all along that way, I don't think he ever... I mean, obviously, God has chosen us from before he created the earth. What we discover along the way is what he already knows. So in the course of our experiences, I came to find out that that was actually a failure of a test of faith that then had to be, in a way, reenacted later to clarify in a different way what I ended up believing. And part of that was coming to terms with that very struggle that I said, never mind, it doesn't work, I don't want any part of it. I had to revisit that struggle too. So I guess what I'm saying is, if you had done this piece right here and looked at me, you would have said, no, my faith failed. And it did. And God is faithful and brought me back. So a couple things from that. One is, I don't think we know until the story's closer to the end. But secondly, I think struggle is really a part of this life. And I don't think we can look at anyone who struggles and say, absolutely. Because if you had looked at me at 25 and said that and concluded it, well, guess what? You'd be wrong. Even though the evidence sure looked good for that conclusion. Does that make sense? And I think that's a really important thing to keep in mind when we see people that we love really struggle, because it could be that God takes them through a really circuitous route.
It almost sounds like what to you it looked like you were losing your faith but maybe in ultimate reality, in much bigger terms, they're all bigger circles, you were losing your false faith.
Yeah.
You were believing in really a God that didn't exist.
Right.
So your own interpretation of God.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So that could be. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I had another thought about that. Also, what that time did for me was it was a very valuable, though very painful, time. And it's not, I mean, God can use anything to show us who we are. But ultimately, I think He is all about showing us who we are in terms of our moral ineptitude, if that makes sense. So, in my high school years, I taught Bible studies, and God was pretty lucky to have me on His team. And part of what that period did in my life was to show me who I really was, and that I had all kinds of rebellion inside me. And I had it inside me when I was teaching those Bible studies in high school. I just didn't know it yet. So I once heard Franklin Graham talk about this, because Franklin Graham went through a similar experience of growing up. His dad was Billy Graham. I mean, you know, probably doesn't get much better than that. And he followed along, did everything right, and then rebelled big time when he was older, and then came back into faith later. And when people have asked him that, he has said, people have asked him things like, gosh, was it something in your family? Was it your parents? Wanted to get these this understanding about it. He said, it was because I'm a rebel. And I heard that many years ago, and really it really hit home for me, because that was very much my experience. And I think that really calls it what it is. We're all rebels that way, and we express it, some in more socially acceptable ways than others. But ultimately, we have to look square on in the face that's who we are inside us. So. Anything else?
Running out of gas story. Sometimes God does provide the gas. And a lot of times. I mean, I've just grown up with my parents are risk takers in a lot of ways. And so I've grown up talking about all the times God has provided for us and all these things. And what is He saying to us with those? I mean, it seems to me like they should have taken those risks.
Mm-hmm.
And they're in the right place with that.
Mm-hmm.
And God has provided for them.
Yeah.
Is it just a different lesson?
Mm-hmm. I think so. Yeah, I don't think that we can look at one particular circumstance and say it's going to mean this. I think it has to do with the context of kind of what I was expecting at that time in my life and what I needed to learn from that God chose to use that to teach me. I, too, have since then continued to take financial risks in order to stay employed here at the McKenzie Study Center, as you can well imagine. And I have seen God provide. And I've seen Him provide for all the different people that work here and other people who serve God in different ways, I think. And, Jack once said, not too long ago on the radio program, he said something about how being on support has... Christine asked him what that's been like for him or something, and he said, it's not that he's any more vulnerable than anyone else. It's just that it might be more clear that he's vulnerable. And I think that that's really true, too, that no matter what we do for a living, God is providing for us. And sometimes well and sometimes not so well from our culture standards, I mean. Sometimes where we have more than we need and other times when we don't have quite what we think we might need. But I do think that the context is kind of what, it's not an all or nothing, Yeah, and I think it's also different it's kind of like with the parking space story. I think that sometimes God might, when we're younger in our faith, take us through. I mean, I think that experience for me was designed to confront me with, like Bill was saying, what I believed in error, where someone who has a more mature faith and isn't going to mistake God's provision for a faulty understanding of the gospel, he might do something really different for them. Does that make sense? Yeah. Yeah. So he might give us parking spaces for the first few years because that's something that is important to us right then, to continue to trust or to come into the fold and decide that God is really real. And I think he really does stuff like that. I'm not trying to make light of that. I think that it's important stuff that he does for beginning Christians who just see amazing things happen. But then I think we also go through this experience of having some of those things fail us and having to clarify as our faith deepens and matures. So,
talking about needs, what is your understanding of the part in Matthew where Jesus says, like, don't worry about what you'll eat or what you'll wear, but seek first the kingdom of God? Because I've always understood serve God, then he'll give you everything you
need. Like I was understanding it that summer. Yeah. I was looking for that passage too earlier, Corey and I. Couldn't find it. I thought maybe I made it up. I know I misinterpreted it. It's in there though. And that actually, that's a different passage that you just referred to than the one I was trying to find. But I think that he's talking about relative values. We say the passage again, remind me.
Therefore, do not worry, saying, what shall we eat, or what shall we drink, or what shall we wear? For all, after all these things the Gentiles seek. Your heavenly Father knows that you need all these things. But seek first the kingdom of God and his righteousness, and all these things shall be added to you.
Okay. I don't know what he means by adding, these things being added to us. But I do think one of the things he's getting at is kind of what I'm talking about clarifying what we want. And the Gentiles seeking these things, he makes a lot of references to even the Pharisees, like praise from men, those kinds of things. This is all they're going to get because this is it for them. And that for you, seeking the kingdom of heaven is more valuable than that. And understanding that we can lose stuff because we are heading toward this place where something much more important than valuing our stuff over goodness, I think is what he's getting at, over treating people well, over being honest about ourselves, the self-righteousness of the Pharisees, that kind of thing. Does that make sense? So I think it's a relative thing in a way. He's saying, he's not saying don't value any stuff. He's saying don't value it as an end in itself because it's going to fade away. It's going to be stolen. It's going to rot because everything about this world ultimately rots. And our physical death is obviously the greatest picture of that. I mean, we die. And he's pointing us to something beyond that, that and saying, where are you going to put your treasure? Are you going to put it in this stuff that's going to go away? Or are you going to put it in this kingdom? And I don't know what he means by put your treasures there and all this will be added, although I do think that there's references like the part about the sparrows and the lilies and how they're fed and clothed and other passages about material things. The trouble is, I mean, I think that God, he talks about noticing when a sparrow falls to the ground. The sparrow might still fall to the ground, but he's saying that God cares about that. That there's purpose and design and authorship going on there. It isn't random, I think. Is that... Because I don't think it's consistent with our experience that God takes care of all of our material needs. I don't think he can mean that, because that doesn't happen. It happens for some of us, but what I've thought about in that context is the mother in Somalia who watches her children starve. I mean, there might be a woman with faith doing that right now, watching that. And so I don't think it can mean that. And yet I think it does mean that doesn't happen without God's care and without God's purpose being accomplished. Ted?
I just wanted to thank you for putting in so much story material just within, because I think what that does is blending that with the theology and the biblical perspective, that it calls up things in our own history that then we can relate, you know, to the biblical and the theological part. Mm-hmm. So I wanted to thank you for that.
Mm. Thanks. You're welcome.
And I do have one question. I don't know if I'm okay to...
Yeah, we have time for one more. As long as I don't, like, tell another story.
Okay.
To answer it.
Well, just making a comment about the part that does change, it seems like you focused on how it changes our faith, strengthen it, deepen it, and it changes our growth. And I'm wondering if a whole third category could get added onto that. I guess I'd call it behavior, the area of obedience, being freed up to serve, to love.
Mm-hmm.
And I was thinking of how would Jesus deal with that question? What really changes?
Mm-hmm.
And it seems like he majored a lot on what changes in our relationships with people.
Mm-hmm.
He focused on that because when you enter the kingdom, you have a whole new attitude towards how you relate to other people, even how you relate to your enemy.
Mm-hmm.
And when evil comes to you, you respond with good.
Right.
And that relational, social perspective, sometimes we kind of can kind of set that aside a little bit.
Yeah.
But I think it's very central for Jesus in this whole issue of what changes. And when he dealt with conversion, and when people asked him, how do I enter into this eternal life? How do I come into the kingdom? Time and time again, he would direct people's focus on, where are you at with other people? Mm-hmm. In relation to where are you at?
Like the story of the Good Samaritan comes to mind. It's a really clear example.
So I think it totally fits with everything you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
But it bears mention because it's easy for us to forget how important it was for Jesus.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I did spend quite a bit of time last time talking about what doesn't change in our character, in our moral ability to love. And I didn't focus as much as I could have on what you're talking about, and I think that would have been helpful. But I think that relationships are actually the context where we have the opportunity more than anywhere else to see who we are and to see how we fail to love fundamentally, and to grow in making wiser choices about how to care about one another as something that can change. But what doesn't change is that we automatically respond, like you're saying, what will happen in the kingdom is when we're offended and we respond with love, true love, right love, not compliance or indifference, you know, pulling away, pretending everything's okay, and then burning on the inside. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a really important context for what the gospel is doing in our lives. I think it's also the context for the trials that I'm talking about, very much the how other people meet our needs or don't meet our needs is a huge piece of what we suffer with in this life. Marriage is this incredible vehicle for showing us what we expect and what we want and what we don't get. And I don't think marriage is the only one. I think living singly can be that too. But anyway, I think you're right. Relationships are a huge piece of what God has put us right into the middle of to show us who we are and to struggle with.
I've kind of realized that I think relationships and how we carry out relationships with others, friend and foe, is part of the storing up of our treasures in heaven, because that's what we do take with us, as opposed to things that we get visited here in this world.
Mm-hmm. And certainly how we love and the character it exposes in us. Yeah.
And how it changes.
Mm-hmm. Right. Okay. I think we're out of time. Thanks.